is pretty hard. It's not the thin heat shrink tubing. It's the kind of stuff that you would use. I forget the name of it. The stuff at work. Once you shrink it down, it won't move at all. Sometimes you got to take an X-Acto knife or a sheetrock knife and slice it open just to get it off. That's how tight it is. There's no movement at all.
Next thing to do is to put an ohmmeter on it and see what's going on.
Yeah, 0.2 ohms from center conductor to ground.
And 0.2 ohms probably in both directions. Sounds like it's still got contact. There may have been a fixed capacitor in there somewhere that ain't making contact that resonated it.
Yeah, I know, I'm picking up too fast with the beat. Yep, that's possible. They show a picture of it, by the way, on their website. And the one that K2KYQ just mentioned. I'll look into this further. I'm kind of curious about it because I built the same type of loop on 2 meters and mine works fine. I have a good null through the loop. And this one is not doing that. So, okay. I will, I'm going to find out more about it.
Is there a way you can get a schematic diagram, Andy?
I'll have to call the company and find out. They don't offer one in the, and on their website that I see.
Do you think the owner's manual might have a schematic in the back? Some of them do.
I gotta look to see. I don't have the book on it because it's not mine. All I see is what's on the website, and that's it.
Okay. You've got us all curious. So when you find out what's going on, please come back and tell us what you found. Anyone want to add any comments to this before Mel goes on to the next item in the mailbag? Give me your call letters right now.
KKYQ, one more time.
Go ahead, Joe.
Andy, if you look at that website, doesn't it show that antenna is designed to work from 1 megahertz on up through, 300, 600, 500, depending upon which model you bought? And if so, it very clearly says it's not designed to be used for transmission. So, I don't know. Go ahead.
It's interesting. It says, I see the warning, and on the bottom, in little print, it says transmitting the dish antenna can damage your radio. It doesn't say it can damage the antenna. It says it can damage your radio, which is different. And it just says the frequency is up to 450 megs, six inches apart, which is what this dimension is. And then that's a VHF model, then they make a UHF model, which is up to 800 megs, which is 3 inches across, a smaller one. This one obviously is a 6-inch model. But they don't specify the actual frequencies that I see. Dick?
To cover that much frequency, certainly sounds like it doesn't resonate. And if it doesn't resonate, it's very difficult for it to build up an antenna pattern that you can know. So we've got a conflict here. If there's no tuning control that resonates it, and if it goes from DC to light, which suggests it does not resonate, then how in the world does it develop a pattern? Do you believe this is intended to be a simple receiving antenna that covers a lot of frequency, or do you believe it was intended to be a direction-finding loop antenna? Does it say it is a direction finding antenna, Andy?
It does. They specify with the offset attenuator that they also make VHF Fox Hunt loop. And they show a picture of it. That's exactly what it has. Fox Hunt loop. And that's what it is. It's a simple loop antenna. $59. Now, I'm not sure, Joe, where you're looking, where it actually specifies the frequency. It just says up to 450 megs. And that's what threw me off also, Nick.
didn't mention that before, but it is kind of broadbanded. So where is it resonating? I can't see it. I can't see it on my MFJ. And I know it doesn't work. So it is kind of puzzling a little bit.
I know what he's talking about.
I've got a guess, Andy. I'm going to pass it over to Mel because he's made the same guess, I'll bet you. They call it a direction-finding loop. And they make sure they want you to buy the offset attenuator. That could be a non-directional antenna where you run around looking at signal strength and using the offset attenuator, and you move in the direction where the signal gets stronger. The loop itself covers a lot of megacycles, but does not have a pattern. That's my guess right now. That by way of you moving and looking at signal strength using the offset attenuator, you eventually find the signal, but without direction finding. That's a guess. Mel?
Exactly. You got it, Dick. Word for word. The offset attenuator, this thing is, like you say, is generally like a field strength type of device. When you use the offset attenuator, in the offset attenuator, I bet you there's a couple of batteries. And what those two batteries do, you have an adjustment, put a null on the offset attenuator that then powers up the varicap that's in that loop. Now, what he's got there, that split end there where he's got that shrinkable tubing, that's a split loop in there. Inside there, there's another wire that goes inside there. That's where the varicap is located, Dick.
I'm having trouble believing there's a varicap in the one that's in Mel's and in Andy's hand because he measures 0.2 ohm. Ain't no varicap going to give you 0.2 ohm. Either it's been shorted, it's been damaged, or it works by a different means. So the fact that it's got no other connection other than BNC, and BNC sent a conductor to ground is 0.2 ohm, and it does pick up signals, so it's not just simply shorted at the connector. I think it's a broadband receiving antenna without direction. You're supposed to be doing your bunny hunting by signal strength alone, as if it was a whip antenna. In theory, you could take the rubber duck antenna on top of your handy doggy, put it through an attenuator of some kind into the handy doggy, assuming your handy doggy has a field strength meter, a signal strength meter. It's a little bit more difficult without direction finding, but you could find the bunny that way. Anybody got any comments on this?
Let me just clear something up.
Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, because I didn't read the whole thing, just this part here. Okay, it is a loop antenna, which should give you a null, because I'm reading the instructions. I'm scrolling down, and it says box on loop, and it says instructions. And the instructions are, and Joe, you probably see this now, unlike some other directional antennas like a Yagi, the loop antenna is used in the null mode, minimum signal. Because the null mode can provide a very sharp bearing, readable to plus or minus 5 degrees. And they show the loop, and they show the null going through the loop, a picture of it, and it says the loop antenna has the advantage of being less affected by deflection signals due to its Faraday shield. By itself, the loop can provide an entire antenna requirement provided the signal is strong enough to be received by the untuned loop. Let's see, I've got to read this again. The loop can provide the entire antenna requirement provided the signal is strong enough to be received by the untuned loop. Untuned. It's interesting it says that. If the signal is too weak, a Yagi is recommended for its directional gain. If the signal is too strong, the use of an attenuator may be required, like the Fox Hunt attenuator that they provide. So it just says, underneath that, it says, not a science, it's a skill, happy hunting. So it is a loop antenna which requires a null, according to what they say.
Now, give them the answer.
The null that they show you is the null in the plane of the loop or perpendicular to the plane of the loop?
The null is through the loop, right through the center of the loop.
In the plane of the loop or perpendicular to the plane of the loop?
Perpendicular to it.
Okay, you got it, Mel. Tell us what's going on here.
okay, this is a split loop like I'm using for receiving. And if you take my split loop, right, and how the variable is wired, it's wired right across supposedly the shield and the sensor that I split up on top. Now, if I measure across that B and C connector that's on my loop, I have nothing. If I shorted that variable condenser, if that variable condenser was shorted, I would get a reading. So if he's getting a reading, because he's getting a reading, because they're not using a variable condenser, using a varicap in that stick. I guarantee you that's what it is, a varicap in that extra little box that they sell you. Basically, makes it so that's why you can get a null, because it's now resonating the loop with the varicap stick. That's the only way he's going to get a measurement, because it's a split loop stick. Over.
Okay. If there's a varicap there, how do you put voltage on the varicap if the only thing he has is a BNC connector with 0.2 ohm? It can't put any voltage across 0.2 ohm. So how did he tune that varicap?
Varicap is dead.
The man is a dog, took my word. Got a shorted varicap, just like I said. If the variable condenser on my receiving loop is shorted, you're going to measure across the BNC, of course. If I had a bent plate on that tuning condenser and I rotated to the bent plate, I short out the thing, that's it. So what's happening? They put power into it and they blew the varicap. It's a very simple thing.
And the varicap is a melted glob for 0.2 ohm. I give it about a 90% chance, Andy. Back to you, Andy.
Yeah, I want to open this thing up and see exactly what's going on. Okay. It's very possible that he did put power into it. Although it's funny with that, in that warning that it does say, it says it may damage your radio. It doesn't say it may damage the antenna, and that's interesting.
Let me ask you this. Does the advertisement, is it worded in such a way that it looks like it is possible to use this antenna as a direction-finding antenna without the variable attenuator, without the offset attenuator? Are they sold as a pair, or is there an implication that the antenna can be used there all by itself? Back to you, Andy.
It says, the heading says BNC mounts directly on an HT or use the 4-megacycle offset attenuator if required, either or.
Oh, ho. So if you're using it all by itself, directly into a handy talkie, and you're getting a null in your direction finding, and it's untuned except for the voltage on the varicap, you got a bunch of unknowns there. Okay, you guys, tell me how you solve that one.
Can you get onto the website and think you got a computer handy?
I sure do. What do I look up?
Arrow antennas. Just do a Google search for Arrow antennas and look up their website. ArrowAntennas.com. And then scroll down and you'll see the products they offer, and then you click on to the one that says Fox Hunters, Media Direction Finding. Click on that.
I ask a question of them, Dick.
Moderator, go right ahead.
See, if you said you read 0.2 ohm, if you reverse the probe, do you still read only 0.2 ohm? Over.
Yes, I tried it both ways. I did.
This very cap is shorted.
But how does that vary cap get tuning voltage when the antenna is placed directly into a handy-talky radio mount?
Don't. That's it. When it's tuned that way, just as a loop, it's just like a random antenna. That's why they tell you 1 to 450 megahertz, because it's an untuned antenna. It's sticking your finger on the sensor terminal of the and saying, well, listen to receive, what do I need an antenna for? I just stick my finger on there. That's it. It's like you say, a length of wire hanging stick over.
Okay, I went to the website. I went to VHF Fox Hunting Antennas. I'm looking at the BNC mount directly on HT. I see this square antenna. I see a little square of metal in the, at the bottom with the four screws and the BNC coming out of the bottom. And you're going to mount that straight into a handy talkie. I better have that directional pattern that they show below with the loop right through, the null right through the loop, the null line as they call it. So, from everything I'm seeing, when it's working correctly, I believe it must resonate. I believe it must resonate. The fact that you can't find a resonance with your antenna analyzer is mysterious. The 2/10 of an ohm doesn't bother me if the wire is just, you know, if the BNC connector goes to a coax cable that goes down the center of one side of that aluminum tubing, and then the semiconductor bridges the gap where you've got the heat shrink tubing, that itself could be a resonance antenna, and you should have seen some resonance. And I guess you're saying you saw not the slightest hint, in other words, near the infinitesimal across the whole range of your antenna analyzer. Is that true, Andy?
That's exactly right. Infinite VSWR from on my highest frequency reading on my MFJ from 150 megs or 100 megs up to 170 megs. No resonance whatsoever, and there's no dip whatsoever when I tried it in doing a little fox hunt this morning. Nothing. So I would think it's defective. But then again, I'm saying to myself, really? I don't know. Maybe they didn't design it that way.
Oh, you got a dummy,
low dick. Well, he got a nice strong signal, but he was in the parking lot with the bunny, so that doesn't tell. My guess is when he opens up those four screws at the bottom, he's going to see a simple assembly that holds it all together with the BNC connector going to a coax cable that goes down one side of that piece of tubing. That's what I think he's going to see. So it's a bit of a mystery. You got to report back to us, Andy, and find out what you find. You got a homework assignment, Andy.
Yeah, I want to open it up. Actually, I tried to open the bottom, but it's so tight. I gotta be careful because again, it's not mine, and I don't want to damage it. I mean, it can't be much to go wrong with it, obviously. But I'm kind of curious to know why I see a low resistance in both directions from the center of that BNC to ground. But I'll keep you updated. I think it's interesting. I'm wondering if these dimensions are even right, because it says it's a broadband antenna, according to the specification. If you look back on the website, it does say it goes up to 350 megs. So if you go back one page, so figure that one out.
Yeah, I think you're going to discover that the four screws are held together with Loctite to make sure they don't come apart. As such, you better make sure you've got an extremely sharp Phillips screwdriver, that it's mounted in something that really holds it very well, like a vise, and that you're pressing down very hard with a very sharp Phillips screwdriver so that you don't slip and burr up the screw slot, the Phillips head screw slot. So, very good screwdriver that's exactly the right size and a whole lot of pressure. And don't go to the point where you strip it, so to speak. And if that doesn't work, then you have to pour acetone around the screws to loosen up the Loctite. Back to you, Andy.
Yeah. Yeah, I got the screws out. Screws came out pretty easy. But to separate the halves of the little block, the metal block, the aluminum block rather, that's holding it together, it's just wedged in there so tight, I'm going to have to pry it apart. And just need to do that. Didn't want to budge, but the screws came out very easily. That's not a problem. All right, I got to get to work tomorrow. Unfortunately, so I got to go. But I will. Let you know what I find, and see if I can get this thing working like it's supposed to.
Yeah, tomorrow's a holiday. Boy, you guys are enthusiastic. Mel's off tomorrow. Time for you to read the next one, Mel.
Thanks, guys. I will keep you posted. WHCDL. Have a good one, Mel.
Okay, went up to the phone. There. Okay, very good, Andy. Yeah, he was supposed to let us know. I will bet on a shorter component than they are. I'm sure it's a foot-loop type of device. And, I remember seeing something like that. I don't remember where, but I'll remember where I saw it. I think it was featured as a homebrew project one time. And I remember the Berry Captain sent it from there. All right, very good. Let's see, you know, we try another one. This werewolf. I'm reading down. Okay, here's a quick quickie. So maybe we, it's getting late. See, after operating my 2-meter FM mobile for some months, I decided that I need a better antenna. Is it worth me building a 5/8 wavelength antenna, where will it be much better than my quarter wavelength antenna that I'm using right now on the mobile? Well, yes, I guess we can say a 5/8 wave antenna should give you, well, theoretically, do they really give you 3 dB difference than the regular mag mount, those cheap eBay cells that go repeat?
I say yes, no. I think you can get about a 3 dB improvement, and the improvement is coming from two places at once. Number one, the 5/8 wave versus a quarter wave has a much lower angle of radiation. That helps. Number two, the 5/8 wave is nowhere near as dependent on the size of the ground plane it's mounted to. That helps. And the 5/8 wave has a phase center that's higher above the ground. To a mobile VHF antenna, altitude is everything. You drive along the New York State Thruway, you're listening to somebody on 2 meters, and it'd be somebody from a long distance away, and you're talking to them on sideband, as I've done, it's a fairly weak signal. You get up to an observation point where you get some altitude, and the guy is 20 dB, 30 dB above the noise. So every little bit of altitude helps. 5/8 wave's got more altitude, less dependence on ground plane, and a little bit more desirable pattern. So as long as you only want 3 dB of improvement, beautiful, go for it. If you're looking for 10 dB of improvement, you've got to look harder. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that's what I figured. Supposedly, you will find it gets at least somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 dB over a quarter wave ground plane. So, yes, simple enough to put together. And most people can assemble it from but with minimum amount of parts if you don't want a homebrew one of them. And from what this gentleman is referring to, that I think I have everything in my junk box to put one together. It's worth the effort. And so, I guess it's unanimous that it's worth the effort. Okay, very good. Next, let's see. Oh, let me read over. Got one here that is asking a question about also about mobile. What is this mobile that I want to do? Oh, how did I get a kilowatt rig? Again, how did I get a kilowatt rig to work in mobile? How did I make the alternator put out a couple of thousand volts? Well, all right. I think I went through that before, so try to skip over that. I don't think I should reiterate what I went through with my kilowatt mobile over.
I'm going to backtrack for a second. The 5/8 wave whip antenna on an automobile is more to it than just extending the length of the radiating section. You don't just extend the radiating section. You've got to have that loading coil and it's usually a tapped loading coil at the bottom. And what that all does is that not only gives you the right impedance match, but that loading coil at the bottom takes the 5/8 wave physical radiator, brings it electronically up to 3/4 wave so that it resonates. You get resonance at 1/4 wave and 3/4 wave. All the odd harmonics, so to speak. Many antennas do that. So you don't just extend. You have to build a structure at the bottom. Now, when it comes to the kilowatt, I think you ought to give them a one-paragraph synopsis as to how you got that much steam out of an alternator. And I think you modified the alternator also. I know you had to work pretty hard. to get the 1,000 watts into her rig, power supply losses, insertion, and the efficiency of the final stage, you're probably developing closer to 2,000 watts to do it. So your alternator from your automobile is not only feeding the battery, the headlights, the air conditioner, and all this other jazz, but it's feeding 2,000 watts into your rig. That takes a pretty healthy fan belt and a pretty beefy alternator. The GP alternator that comes with the car from the factory at 60 amperes, I suspect would not do it. Over to you, Mel.
Welcome. Exactly. You put it very, very right, Dick, when you said that. Well, first of all, the 5 ATS at 60%, you have to put a, make a coil, and in fact, you will put a ice on it, have a little capacitor, a trimmer capacitor. I have a little trimmer capacitor that I have there so that I can adjust the 5/8 antenna. And I'm trying to remember what I'm adding to the board. I don't remember. I'm trying to understand, but I can't see it right now. But, you know, like you see it in the manual there. What's the next? I can't remember the capacitor value, but it was a small trimmer capacitor. I set it so I could resonate it exactly. About the alternator, what I did. Well, that's a whole story in itself. That you can't, the car alternator, this is the problem. They sell these amplifiers now for mobile, these 700 watt solid state amplifiers, Dick. But if you see what they require in current, is there an alternator that you could buy in order with your car and it's going to be more than 60 amperes? Is such a thing available? I wonder now, Dick, over.
There used to be a Lise Nivelle brand name that even at 12 volts back in those days, I think would produce something like 150 amperes if you gave it a big enough fan belt. I said right now. Did I say 150 amperes? Yes, I did. 150 amperes is close to 2,000 watts. I'd like to believe that the majority of 700 watt amplifiers, and I've been working on 700 watt amplifiers these days at the 1296 megacycles or that region, and they all run on 24 and 48 volts. So one approach would be to force your automobile to have 24 volts or 28 volts supplied. Then getting 700 watts is easy. 700 watts solid state on 12 volts, very difficult design. You're putting a whole lot of transistors in parallel. And if you don't do it just right, boy, there's only 40 ways it can break into oscillation and kill itself. And it's very standing wave ratio sensitive. It's going to have all kinds of protection circuits. So I almost don't recommend going beyond, I'm going to pick a number, 150 watts, solid state, with 12 volts in an automobile. Beyond that, it's been done. A buddy of mine did run 700 watts. He got a piece of military equipment that was made for 12 volts. That's the good news. And I remember talking to him on this repeater as he drove home all the way out to Port Jefferson every day. And he sounded good, but he burned up alternators every 3 months. So it was heavy on current drain, and the alternators could put out that current intermittently, but he was long-winded, and he was burning them up. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, I see. I'm looking here. Tokyo High Power offers a 750-watt HF amplifier for the mobile. And I'm saying to myself, it's 12 volts. That's, yeah, but they don't tell you what's the peak current. They don't tell you the advertising what the peak current is there. I'm saying a stock alternator on a car. You go buy a new car. And what's the largest alternator that you can order with the car? Now, what you're talking about, my old Lease Nivelle, yes, that was an alternator. That was a Lease Nivelle alternator that I salvaged that came off an ambulance that I used. And it was double belted. First of all, I had to change the main pulley on the engine because I had to put two belts. It required two belts, and on top of it, it had four terminals that come out there. and it used a big selenium rectifier, 100 ampere selenium rectifier that you mounted. In those days, you mounted that in front of the radiator in the car. What I added on there was a transformer. I had a transformer that was made that had three windings on it, three 12-volt windings and a secondary that were 170-volt secondary. And each circuit, each one of these circuits had a voltage doubler, so that my final voltage was around 2,000, 2,200 volts. And that was the power up to pair of 4X250 that were in the trunk. So I could only run that power, of course, when the engine was running. But with at least a valve alternator, I could say that was a boot of an alternator, but I don't think you can get that set anymore, Dick, if I'm not mistaken. You're not going to find that on any new car. And how the heck are you going to run one of these 12-volt, 750-watt rigs in a car? Can you imagine the peak current that amplifier is going to pull if it can be pushed to the full 750 watts, Dick? I can't imagine how they do it, over.
Why the CB is doing it, they have special alternatives. Guys are running kilowatts out of cars.
Okay, if you're running single sideband HF, 750 watts, peak envelope power, with an average of, let's say, 300, doable. But in FM repeater service, which is a high duty factor, quite often Class C, 700 watts output means you're probably putting darn close to 1,400, 1,500 watts in, which means you're drawing more than 100 amperes. Wait a minute. Yeah, more than 100 amperes. I'm pretty sure nowadays you can still buy the alternator that's used for a fire engine, an ambulance or something like that. They make some really big alternators. And like you say, it's going to require a double belt, because to get that amount of power through the belt, the highest power in the average automobile is the power going between the engine and the compressor for the air conditioner. And that's a really healthy belt. You need something beyond that. Right? Really big, wide things with a whole bunch of ridges to it. So it's doable, but considering the size conductors required to conduct that kind of amperes for long duty factors, I think you're way ahead of the game to do whatever's required to make it a 28-volt system instead of a 12-volt system. I think there's also a movement to make modern-day cars at a higher voltage. Remember, way back in our early days, Mel, automobiles had 6 volts. And they made the shift to 12 volts and saved a lot of copper. And there's now talk about them going to the next higher voltage, either 28 or 56, numbers like that. But the wiring becomes a lot lighter, and some of the circuitry comes out ahead. And particularly when it comes to electric automobiles with the energy saving on braking, you know, recharge or whatever it's called, dynamic braking, there's a lot of advantage of higher voltages. Back to you, Mel, with a little bit of delay, if anyone wants to add to the K2LIW.
Roger, this is K2KTY. Yeah, I can see that. I don't know how you could possibly mount a leaking valve alternator into one of these new cars with front wheel drive, you know, with transverse engine. Yeah, that's never, and especially, I think you said they all use this blind belt, this non-flippable belt. You can't belt that onto a, I never saw a leaking valve alternator that takes that. You're not going to be able to modify the car to put in the right pulley on the bottom and everything. I just can't see how you're going to resist it. You need a real hefty alternator. The alternators that they come with, come in a car, and there's cars now, even they've got a 60-amp alternator. I can't see. This is a 12-volt. No, it says there. It's a 12-volt power supply that it requires to run this Tokyo 750 watts mobile contraption. I think, wait a minute, also doesn't what's the other company also make one? I mean, look, what the heck is the same company that makes the Rich's amplifier? Rich, if you're still on frequency, don't they also make a Meritron? I believe, Rich, do they also make a solid state mobile amplifier, Rich, over.
That was two.
Can I do now with the 600-watt amplifier? I can go to MHR.com and look it up. But I'll bet you that's a 600-watt single sideband amplifier. If you want 600, 700, or 1,000 watts for mobile CW FM service, I think the easiest way to do it, Mel, is to buy the biggest alternator you can get that will go into your car. Most automobiles these days, I think they come with a 60 or a 70 ampere alternator. When you're buying the car, you can buy the accessory, the premium alternator, which I believe is 100 amperes, maybe it's 110. Then here's the smart thing to do. Set it up in such a way that you've added the second battery to the car. And you set it up with diodes or whatever in a relay so that you charge the batteries in parallel. But the batteries flip with a relay to the series mode when you're running the transmitter key down. So the transmitter sees battery power of 25 volts when the transmitter is running. Your alternator keeps charging the bottom battery. And then the two batteries are put quasi-parallel with the steering diode when you're in the receive mode, and your alternator is charging the two batteries simultaneously. Because one of the batteries is going to discharge a little bit more rapidly, it's the one that's going to be lower in voltage. It's going to take more of the current out of the alternator. So don't try to make the alternator produce the power continuously. Just make it produce enough power on average, but the peak power when you're transmitting is coming from a good set of batteries. I think that might be a slightly easier approach, and now you're building solid-state 28-volt amplifiers. At that kind of power level, at 28 volts, is a lot easier to find transistors that'll do it. I've now found some beautiful transistors that run 150 watts per device, put as many of them into a balanced amplifier combination as you like to get whatever power you want. And some of these modern day transistors, up to the 1,000 megacycle region, 150 watts, 21 dB of gain in the stage. I think these are called VMOS or DMOS transistors. Beautiful devices. And they run on 28 volts. So get the 28 volts from a pair of batteries in series, but charge them in parallel. I think that might be easier than other techniques of trying to get true 28 volts all the time into the car. Back to you, Mel.
Welcome to the W2L repeater.
Yeah, well, that's what they offer. They offer to amplify the 13.8 volt system and uses FET. And to run that mobile, I think that you're going to have to figure out how to get the extra battery. You've got to make sure your alternator, first of all, is capable and all. It's a project and a half right now. You've got to have one of these big SUVs because you're not going to get this into a subcompact, that's for sure. It's just not to even put a 100-watt mobile rig in, you know, like the Icon 706 or something, and you'll be happy. And all. It'll work and everything like that. Why you want to try this is ridiculous, because it's not like the old days, like Dick was talking about. We had small things, big alternators available, you know, like the valve with plenty of room under the hood where you can do all this manipulation. You just can't do it in the newer cars. I can't see it. Not practical, Dick. Unless they go to a 24-volt car eventually. I think they will. I think they're going to go get away from, as they went away from 6 volts or went to 12, I guess the next step is going to be like aircraft. 24-volt system takeover.
I agree with you. A modern-day compact and subcompact car with front-wheel drive, where the transmission, the differential, the swing axles, all of that jazz is up front. The front of the car is packed so tight that you have to put the car on a lift at a garage just to tighten the fan belt. You ain't going to add a second battery and all this jazz and an alternator and the by alternator now we really mean the chunk of electronics that steps 12 volts or 24 volts up to whatever. a kind of a alternator circuit. Inverter is what I'm trying to say. So don't try this at home on your subcompact with front wheel drive. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, definitely looking for electrical problems, especially in any new cars today. They got all these computers and things just start fooling around, and you wind up blowing out something that it'll cost you minutes to replace. So the best thing is, I think, is just, if you, in fact, I wonder, that's another thing, I wonder, if you go to high power like that, if it possibly can, you know, because I heard that there was a number of companies that were saying that if you, you know, put a high-powered transmitter in the car, that you can damage computers or whatever in the car, and they don't warranty that. I have heard this, I think, in a past takeover.
I'm with you on that one, Mel. Your emission control computer is built in such a way that it is not specifically shielded from high RF fields. So you'd have to do a study of the way it is built, laid out, all the wiring through it. I mean, an emission control computer has sensors on the transmission, sensors on the exhaust gas recirculator, it's got sensors for the oxygen sensor, it's got wires all over the place. It's got antennas up the kazoo monitoring the 10 or 15 separate positions on that engine powertrain system. And a lot of that is good, solid wiring, but it is not shielded from RF. It is not coaxial cable with, you know, BNC connectors or SMA connectors on each end. So it's going to be picking up a lot of your high-power RF, and I think it's a medium good chance you're going to get yourself in trouble. That emission control computer, if you blow it, damage it, or really screw it up badly, I think just the raw part itself is a $700 item, and to get it installed and repaired, I don't think you're going to walk out of that shop for less than $1,200 if you blow that emission control computer. Back to you, Mel.
Sure about that. These things run very, very expensive, these units that are in the car right now, these computer boxes. So, word to the wise, I wouldn't even think of going there with the power and all this problem with the DC alone, and then with coming with RF problems and all, and then the antenna and all, you got to have a good antenna, you know, that can handle that kind of power, mobile antenna, so it's going to be a good heavy width antenna. Most of them are specified. You got to look also on the antenna site. For instance, I use a Neutronic Cluster Width. They got two loading coils. I have to have the heavy loading coils, which I don't even use anymore, but if you looked at my 20-meter coil that I used in the high power when I ran the high power number, the car, you should see that coil in comparison to the one I'm running right now, which is only rated for 150 watts. So you've got to have a good mounting on the car there to, you know, handle that kind of antenna like that. So it's too much. It's just too much things to get involved with. Let's say you've got a truck or something. You know, and maybe that's another story. But okay, I think we'll let that go, Dick. You have time, you think, for one other? Go ahead.
If you're enthusiastic, we got about 11 minutes left.
Okay, I'm just reading down here. That's a lot of questions, things here and all. I don't know if we should tackle this one here. I bought a device at a Hamvention. It says on it, SAW. What is it? It says they said it's good for being used for antenna circuits and other things. It was very cheap, and it's, I believe it's for UHF, an SAW UHF device. I think I know what it is. I think you talked about it, you know, a surface acoustic wave type of device, Dick. I think that's most likely what he's talking about for UHF. All right, you make a comment on it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've worked with SAW filters, SAW filters. And there's also a magnetic equivalent, I think, called BAW filters, but at one time, the on 1,000 megacycles was very difficult. They've broken that sound barrier. When you look at one of these as a schematic diagram blown up from a microscope picture of the actual chip that's doing all the work, you start off with a piezoelectric crystal of material. This is material that changes physical shape when you apply voltage to it. It's got a whole bunch of interdigitated fingers on the sending section. So on the left-hand side of this integrated circuit, left-hand side of this strip of acoustic material, of piezoelectric material, you got a bunch of fingers on the left-hand side of this, let's call it a bar, which launches a signal that goes down the bar, and you got a bunch of interdigitated fingers on the piezoelectric device on the right-hand side, which receives the signal. And with proper impedance matching, so you don't get triple transit of the acoustic signal that's flowing through the crystal. It's hard to believe that, say, at 500 megacycles, you could be generating an acoustic signal, which is physically moving the crystal, and that acoustic signal is flowing down the crystal. But properly done, these SAW filters can give you a whole lot of holes in a very small package. I remember looking at one of these things where it was about 3/4 of an inch long, about 1/4 of an inch wide, and probably 10/1000 of an inch thick, and it was simulating something like a 20-hole filter at VHF, UHF frequencies. So you can get a whole lot of holes in that filter in a very small package. They used to have a very high insertion loss. Nowadays, the insertion loss is only a couple of dB. They're rather high Q. They've got a lot of potential. No normal guy is going to buy one of these and tune it to his frequency. You buy it built to the frequency you want it on, and you ain't going to move it very much. The good news, you get a lot of poles, small package. Let me drop a second. The bad news is they all have a triple transit problem. In other words, you send a pulse of signal down this filter, and it's got a delay of microseconds. It acts like hundreds or thousands of feet of cable because it's an acoustic wave flowing down a bar of piezoelectric material. So it's got significant delay. That's either a disadvantage or an advantage depending on what you want to do. I mean, if you need a delay line that's thousands of feet long, a SAW device can do it for you in a very small package. Another potential advantage. But then the receiving fingers on the right-hand side of this bar of material, of piezoelectric acoustic material, must be very properly impedance matched so that it absorbs all of that acoustic wave flowing down the bar. Because if any of it reflects back, you get what's called the triple transit problem. They all have it to some degree. As such, any normal LC filter, when you get down into the skirt region where the signal is falling off 30, 40, 50, 60 dB, it keeps on falling. In the case of a SAW filter, it gets down to the 50-60 dB level, and then if the first pass through the filter has a millisecond of delay, you're going to get a second signal with 3 milliseconds of delay that's 60 dB weaker. You're going to get echoes. It's called the triple transit problem. To some degree, they've all got it. As long as you're not looking for signals with 60 dB of rejection, then it's a beautiful device. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger, yeah, basically, what he most likely picked up. They have a lot of them. They're sold very cheap because some of them in fact, I think they stick them in cellular phones. Yeah, no doubt they have it in cellular phones because said spread the spectrum communication system used them very extensively. Also, and the TVIF filters. That they use a SAW filter in there in the TV, the color TV set, the modern color TV set. So as Dick would just say, they actually were used as microwave communications to form the basis of the oscillators, amplifiers, bandpass filters, discriminators, and other kind of match filter devices, basically. Very cheap device. And they have many applications, and basically you have an RF acoustic transducer in the input and the output, and that's how it really works, just the way Dick described it. I believe they used it in some of the more modern radar systems, use pulse compression and expansion, and what do they call that? That Suedo random code system, if I'm not mistaken. Dick, am I correct? Over.
Pseudo, P-S-E-U-D-O, pseudo random coding, also pulse compression radar, which uses dispersion. You can design a filter with SAW devices where the amount of time it takes for the signal to go down the filter is shorter and shorter as you go to higher and higher frequencies, or vice versa. You can make the filter tilt in the time domain so that the higher frequencies go through faster and the lower frequencies go through slower. And so is the bandpass filter. That's called dispersion. So therefore, you can put a pulse down that filter, and the filter, and this radar is a chirped radar, where you come onto the air at frequency A, you swoop to frequency B during the pulse, and then go off. And the pulse could be, let me pick a number, 20 microseconds long, with a frequency sweep during the pulse. You send out that dispersed signal as a radar transmitter. It hits the target and reflects back. When it reflects back, you put it through this soft dispersive filter, which takes the sweep with the various delay times and compresses all of a sudden 20 microseconds of pulse that you transmitted becomes a tenth of a microsecond pulse that comes out of your receiving filter. So what you're going to say, why in the world do you want to do that? Well, when you take all the energy of a pulse that was 20 microseconds long, and you squeeze it into a pulse that's a tenth of a microsecond long, the pulse gets 200 times stronger. That gives you a radar with a hell of a lot more range resolution, a hell of a lot more range, a hell of a lot more sensitivity. And it's a very difficult radar to jam, because it's not on one frequency. It's grouping over a whole band of frequencies. So that's a whole exotic field in itself, pulse compression radar. Properly used, it can do some magic. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. Yeah, I remember reading extensively about that system, especially, what did he call it, storing digital, actually it stores it like digital information. It's, yeah, quite an elegant piece of gear. And so that's what soft filters are, but what you most likely picked up, I would say, is very possible one that they use in TV sets. Basically, what the ones that they use in TV sets, very cheap. You can buy them for less than a dollar a piece. That's why you saw them laying out on the table. And they actually considered electro-acoustic transducers. I guess if you really want a comparison, there really is. It's just like a loudspeaker, a headphone, a microphone type thing. They just convert, let me put it in simple words. They convert electrical to acoustic energy and then vice versa. I guess that's the simplest way. But instead of being driven at audio frequencies, you can drive these SAWs. Can operate at RF up to power. Like Dick said, they can go to up into the gigahertz. Okay, I guess that sort of gives you an idea of what the SAW or transducer does. All right, I guess we better start closing it up, Dick. And, I guess in about a minute we'll have to say goodnight over.
Yeah, we should say goodnight, Dan. Goodnight, Dick. We got 2 minutes left. You guys have wasted another 3 or 4 hours of your life listening to TechNet number 1,171 of the series that began 25 and a quarter years ago in September of 1982. Seems like there's enough questions to keep going. And on the assumption that Mel and Dick stay healthy, we'll be back next week. And you guys keep sending in those cards and letters by email. And there's a lot more to learn. What we discuss is what you guys decide you want to discuss, what questions you bring to the floor. And sometimes you get answers. The price is right. Send me through. You all be kind to each other. Mel, let's tie the ribbons on it. K2LIW.
Hey, Dick, about summed it up. Thank you all. And we try to answer many. I know we've still got a bunch of emails here and all, but little by little, just be patient. We'll try to get through some of the other questions, similar questions that I think that I just bang out on the keyboard. You think I will answer them, but please keep it in the realm of electronic, ham radio, electronic, things of that sort. I am not an expert on computers, so please, I can't give you answers to software problems. I need help in that division. And also, I will not, also again, I will not comment on anybody who would want to invest in something, nor will I review people that are going to give me pages of that they would like me to scan over the mathematics and things like that. No, I just can't take the time out to get involved in things like that. So keep it simple with amateur radio, and we're more than glad to help you. 73 12, good night, and again, thank you for joining us. This is KCTY.